that it's the ERF stream, at least as I copied it. So whatever the problem with Echolink is, it's in the Echolink path, or specific part of the path to Echolink, because the IRLP 9126 was fine. V3 says he said.
That's very good information, Scott. Makes me feel a little bit more comfortable. That more of the system really was working. From your point of view, Scott, on a slightly different subject, EME moonbounds in the Golden Horseshoe area of Canada. Have you known any moon bouncers? Have you had a chance to talk to them? Have you visited their sites? I know there are quite a few of them, but are they in the hinterlands or are they in the major metro area? Give me a couple of words on your exposure to moon bounce in Canada. V3ZTZ, K2RIW.
I do not know anyone who practices moon bounces in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, that's on the air. The only ham with a site set up for moon bounce is in a small town called Bancroft, which is about 325 kilometers north of Toronto, cottage country for us, about a 3 hour or so drive, and he has a setup that I've seen by day, so I haven't actually seen it working by evening.
AC2IS, info.
Okay, that's good to know. Bill, AC2IS, go ahead.
Hey, Dick, just wanted to let you know that the government shutdown during that time, federal employees are not allowed to report to work. There was a specific issue where I believe it was chaplain contractors who typically worked on Army bases were not allowed to visit the Army bases to do their work. There was a bit of a controversy about that. Can we break for a second? And the second point was, are they going to be paid? I believe that legislation has been passed that will allow government workers to be paid for the time they were not working. Not sure if that covers everyone, but it certainly does cover certain key government employees.
And when you think about it, Bill, this sure is crazy. It's crazy that our government employees are doing this temper tantrum, as it's been called by Bill Moyers, the temper tantrum that if they don't get their way, they're not going to play the game. They're going to take their bat and ball and go home. That's sort of what they've done. They're not getting their way, and therefore responding, and then other people are going to suffer. And so the shutdown is to save money, so to speak, and yet in the process of saving money, we're furloughing people, and certain percentage of the people that we furloughed continue to get paid for the time they're not working. Tell me what's wrong with that picture. some of the European newspapers are saying the United States is attempting to go into a meltdown. K2IS, K2LIW.
NY2HF, I comment on that.
Very fine, Dennis. Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick, yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. It's all very nonsensical. One other thing about moon bounce, I don't think anybody had mentioned the JT65 visual mode, and I was wondering why that was.
Okay, JT65, I lumped that under all of the WSJT modes, weak signal Joe Taylor. I think JT65 is a subset of it. I might be wrong on that. But all of the so-called digital modes, the computer-assisted modes, and among the pure moon bouncers of yore, the guys 10 and 20 years ago, they're quite unhappy that the people with these modern-day computer programs are able to use one-eighth of the amount of equipment and still do moon bounce, and they think it's a bit unfair that they get the same amount of credit. And so there really should be a separate list. But I think it's a digital mode like WSJT. Am I completely wrong on that one? Now, Bill, go ahead.
I know you're exactly right. I guess I just didn't put that together at the time. But yeah, JT65 is something that has
All right. Dennis, make sure you wait for the beep. NY2HF, KQRIW, go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to extrapolate on what you were saying. You know, it's, you know, they're looking to save money, so they shut down government, but they're going to pay the workers for not working. But if this stretches out to the full, then that means that all the borrowing and everything else, and also the goodwill, so to speak, is going to become more expensive in the future. So it's really a lose-lose proposition. I just don't agree with it. You know, I just don't get it. I just think that the country has gotten to the point where it's really dysfunctional. These guys, you know, there's too much money getting thrown at them, and we got to get the money out of the politics, and we got to make it, you know, public finance for campaigns. Back to that. Go back to you, Tim.
Yeah, I'm in rather strong agreement on quite a few of the things you said, Dennis. Right now, things have become set up in such a way that private corporations are essentially allowed to give large sums of money to political entities in order to pursue their particular goals, and they can do it in a way that is thoroughly hidden. That doesn't sound right. It sounds like all kinds of corruption, collusion, whatever, hanky-panky, and power can take place in the process of doing that. That should be stopped. Second of all, certain employees are being furloughed, and yet the government employees making these decisions, they continue to get their raises that they vote for, and they continue to get their salary. I'm reasonably sure that their motivation for doing this would be very different if they simultaneously had to be furloughed, so that if government employees, and they are government employees, if government employees are being furloughed, I think our congressmen and senators should also be furloughed, and I guarantee a lot less of this would take place. I suspect that this whole episode is going to have a significant effect on the next couple of elections. As long as people have not too much amnesia of memory and to remember what we're going through, I'd like to believe the next couple of elections are going to have an influence. NY2HF, for any other comments? Wait for the beep, KQRIW.
Yeah, Dick, you know, yeah, I think there's going to be a change over the next couple of election cycles. But the problem is, and we've seen it too many times, Americans are so distracted by sporting events and everything else, and, you know, it's like that shiny object thing, where they just don't put the time into, you know, looking at this stuff. They think that somebody else is taking care of it. Well, somebody else is taking care of it, but they may not be taking care of it the way you might want them or believe they should be taking care of it. And they've been allowed to be, you know, left to their own devices for much too long. I think we've got to rein in all these people in Congress and the Supreme Court, you know. We just got a whole hornet's nest going on. Back to you, Dick, from NY2HF.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. Scott, I'll bet you guys in the United Kingdom and Canada have never done anything quite like this. Is that true? B3ZTZ, and what would you do to correct it if you had the power? KQRIW.
Well, my first comment is that the decision makers, the people who are stoking the fires here, are not, by legal definition, government employees. Their legal definition is constitutional officers, and they wrote themselves in that they shall always be paid because they're not ever excused from their constitutional duties unless they resign their offices. So constitutional officers are paid no matter what. Whether they should or should not be is a whole other question, and I probably would be should not be pile, but they're constitutional officers, not government employees. No, Canada hasn't quite experienced this sort of shutdown. What happens up here is when, if the government puts forward a budget, if the budget is defeated, the defeat of a budget bill is considered a non-confidence motion, and in such case, the non-confidence motion succeeds, and we're going to an election, because we don't have elections on fixed four-year cycles. Government calls it when it wants to, or when it's defeated by a confidence motion. So if we don't get a budget, it's a non-confidence motion in the government, and we're going to an election. D3ZTZ.
I see certain advantages in that system. In the case of healthcare, arguably, you have a more complete healthcare system than we have ever had. We have something like 40 million Americans without any kind of healthcare, to which you'd say, well, we can ignore them. Well, you can't. They appear at the emergency rooms of various hospitals, and if you're the operator of that hospital, you've got the choice of, in some cases, letting the person die or giving him free service. Well, what you call free service is not really free. Somebody else is going to pay. So where our citizens are complaining about the fact that their insurance premium rates might go up because we're picking up these 40 million or so previously uninsured people, they're forgetting about the fact that you have been paying for them anyhow, just in an indirect manner. And so with the healthcare system that you have, I think an awful lot of these problems don't exist. On top of that, you're able to get pharmaceuticals at far cheaper prices than we are. And there's something peculiar going on there. And a lot of our citizens are buying pharmaceuticals from Canada. V3ZTZ, T2RIW.
Yeah, copy that. I'll just quickly go back to your moonbounce question. I just, obviously somebody's listened to me and sent me an email here. Victor Echo 3, ONT, short for Ontario, Oscar November Tango, V3ONT, is a big dish antenna for moonbounce purposes up in Algonquin Park, which is not far from the Bancroft area that I mentioned. I'm not sure that it's in continuous use, though. I seem to remember that it was in a state of disrepair, and one of the ham clubs was trying to raise some money to get it back up and into its glory days. But VE3ONT is it's a big moon bounce antenna up here. Going to trip and come back. On the healthcare question, yes, because the government is it's what's called a single-payer system. Only the government pays bills. They're allowed, they therefore go to the pharmaceutical and say, you know, amoxicillin is not going to be a dollar a pill, it's going to be a penny a pill, because we're the only people you can sell it to, and we're the only people who are going to write you a check. So we have been able to leverage that. It comes with an interesting price tag, though, because usually the pharmaceuticals negotiate tax breaks, which allows them to set up manufacturing facilities here for the generic systems in particular, which allows them to make their profits everywhere else in the world, well, not paying manufacturing taxes here locally. But so they... Like you said, nothing's a free lunch. So what we get in a lower price pill, they make up for tax exemptions and profits elsewhere in the world. VE3ZTZ.
Very fine, and thank you for that information, Scott. In the case of VE3ONT and that great big Algonquin dish, one of those expeditions to put that on the air for moonbounds was headed by K2UIH, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel. Dr. Alan Katz, he and his staff of merry guys went up there with permission and used the dish, which was in a certain state of disrepair, as such, to aim it correctly at the moon. They set up a camera at the feed point to track the moon. And the camera would feed a signal down, you keep the image of the moon in the center of the picture, and everything's hunky-dory. One of Murphy's laws that came along was such that you put the camera in the mode where it sends the picture, and it only does it for a certain period of time, maybe a couple of minutes, and then it goes into a standby mode. You have to keep pushing the button to say, send me the picture now. And they didn't have a way of doing this by remote control. Let me drop this. So in order to continue pushing that button, Alan literally mounted himself at the feed horn, at the camera, and continuously was pushing that button to keep it operational in order for the moonbound schedules to be met. And after being at the feed horn for a certain length of time, as I heard the story, Alan had to ask them that on the string that was in his pocket, he passed the string down, went into the string down, and said, hey, you guys, you got to pass me up some kind of a can so that I can remove fluid, if you know what I mean. So they ran into some peculiar problems. Alan had another situation where he went down to, I think it was Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, to put that particular section, state, or grid square on the map. And he forgot about the fact that the pilot light on his rig had gone out. So while he's on the top of this lighthouse in the dark, he couldn't see the frequency dial because the pilot light was out on his transmitter. And so he rapidly ran out of matches in order to find out what frequency he was on. The funny things that can that come along with Murphy's Law or Elmer's Law, if you know what that means, in situations like this. I wonder if you heard any of those Algonquin stories. I think there's a lot more to it than I've given you so far. B3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Negative. I have not heard too many stories from the V3ONT saga. V3JIW, Jim, who's on here sometimes, would probably have a chest full of them. He's the one who sent me the email. Not sure why he's not transmitting. Maybe he's listening by streaming audio. But if he's out there, he's probably got the chest full. Maybe we should just pause for a second and see if he's in there, if that's okay with you. VE3JIW, are you out there? Well, nothing heard locally. This is VE3ZZ. Back to K2RW.
I vaguely remember that the VE3ONT radio astronomy dish is something in the vicinity of 160 feet in diameter. Does that sound approximately right? I guess it's a little bit more than 50, 55 meters. Over to you, Scott.
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I think that sounds right, because I've seen pictures of people and vehicles in front of it, and that perspective seems right.
When it comes to moon bounce, I should have mentioned the fact that at the meeting that's coming up in a week or two for the microwave update that's going to take place in Kentucky, the guys who are heading that operation are going to be aiding Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, who is the guy who has created the most amount of ham radio available, 78 gigahertz amplifiers. So he's going to be taking an assembly of those 78 gigahertz amplifiers, combining their power, I think getting up to the 10 watt category, and using the radio telescope that's at that university. I've forgotten how big the radio telescope is. They intend to do moon bounce for the very first time on 78 gigahertz. Now, the calculated beam width of that great big dish at 78 gigs, if it has enough surface accuracy, is something in the vicinity of a tenth of a degree of beam width, which means they're going to be creating a hot spot somewhere in the middle of the moon. Let me drop. And if they're able to find a nice crater on the moon that acts like a corner reflector, they would get a stronger than normal signal. Finding that crater is going to be a good trick. Does the dish have enough accuracy? to aim a dish of a tenth of a degree beam width, you'd like to have 0.05 degrees of plus or minus error in azimuth and elevation of the aiming of the dish. The dish was never intended for anything like a frequency as high as 78 gigs. So there's a bunch of pluses and minuses here. I've had a couple of emails with Dr. Tom Williams on this exact subject. So as I said to him, he's got a fairly serious challenge of finding the right focal point on the dish, hoping the dish has enough surface accuracy, aiming it correctly, tracking the moon, finding the right hot spot, and finding somebody else on 78 gigs to talk to. Maybe just hearing your own echoes will be pretty good. So in a couple of weeks, we'll be hearing the result of that attempt. And so I think that is currently the highest frequency at which amateurs have ever done moon bounce, if they are successful. V3ZTZ, Q2RIW.
Well, the analogy would be there. It would be like driving a motor vehicle on a back country road, no streetlights, on a moonless night, with, instead of a headlight, a laser beam. 1 millimeter diameter laser beam is not going to give you a lot of road illumination. It may go for miles in front of you, but it's not going to light the road. V3ZTZ.
In the case of those thousands of people who had to walk down thoroughly darkened stairs of the World Trade Center during the 9/11 incident, even that laser would have been a real blessing. A few of the smart people would always carry some kind of a flashlight, or even a light-emitting diode type K-ring finder, if you know what I mean. They needed light in the worst way, going down these very narrow stairs in the dark, and close to 100 floors of them, under very trying conditions. So having the right kind of light at the right time is really worth it. In the case of a laser pointer, if you wave it around with just the right pattern, knowing the way the human eye can take a scanned picture, a raster scanned picture, that's partially raster scanned, but put it all together and make an image out of it. With real smart scanning of the laser pointer, you might do all right if you're not running the two-wheel vehicle too fast. Over to you, Scott, K2RIW.
Copy that. Prior to the big blackout that hit us all there in 2003, a couple of years before that, Toronto experienced about half the city went dark for about 4 to 6 hours. And I happened to be in our subway system when that happened, and it was evening. And the subways came to, although they run on DC power, they are obviously fed by utility power. 400 volts, 10,000 ampere on the third rail. Anyway, we came to a stop, and unfortunately, we came to a stop in the tunnel between stations. Now, the train has emergency lighting, one bulb over each doorway. So we were sitting in dim light, but we were lit for about 6.5 minutes. And then suddenly, because they're fluorescent, they flickered and went out. And let's say, because it was evening time, average of 20 people per car, not busy time, suddenly everybody gets real nervous because you're sitting in the dark with strangers. And I mean dark, black, dark. Can't see your own hand in front of your face. Ever since that episode, I have always carried an LED key fob. And in my computer note bags and my saddle bag for what I carry my stuff around in, I also have what's called a turtle brand light, just for such emergencies. You only get caught short like that once if you're smart. V3ZTZ.
Interesting story. And yes, that 2003 event, I know where I was at the instant the lights went out on the East Coast of the United States, a good portion of it, and quite an event. Let there be light. Now, in the case of the Toronto Metropolitan Transit System, subway system, I think you guys are considerably ahead of New York City when it comes to communication for transit police, civilian police, Canadian mounted police, I guess it is, and when it comes to Wi-Fi connectivity and cell phone connectivity, I have reason to believe that the Toronto subway system is working considerably better in those wireless areas than is the New York City subway system. I wonder if you have some experience on that one, then, Scott. V3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Oh, no. 180 degree about face on that one. Negative, negative, negative. In fact, I forget his call sign, but I was talking to somebody down there a couple nights ago about this during one of my insomniac episodes there, who was apparently up here and installing the 800 megahertz system for the police to repeat the police frequencies down into the tunnel, into the station. That job was only completed about two and a half years ago. We only just moved to, the police department just only moved to a transit division, because they now have radios. Their radios work with the mothership, as it were. No, we do not have cellular repeats, in the system. So, if it leaks down the staircase, it works. Our subway is hybrid. There's outdoor and indoor sections. So there's, you get coverage if you're in the outdoors, and you get coverage if you're close enough to a tunnel endpoint where the signal will leak in. But nope, no repeat inside the TTC. There's a $40 million proposal, private company looking to do it. But they're in a scrap with the cellular providers over the fees to do the repeating. So someone was suggesting in the newspaper editorials that that could be 2 years away before they settle the legal battles. So, no, we're way behind the rest of the world in those regards with our transit system. V3ZTZ.
I'm a little bit surprised to hear that. Okay, so that's what's true in the Toronto area. How about the other subway systems in other metro areas, like Ontario? And I can't think of the name of the French-speaking town. Are any of the other subway systems, to your knowledge, in Canada, a little bit better off on wireless connectivity? Over to you, Scott, K2LIW.
Affirmative. There's only, I'm pretty sure I'm correct in this, there's only subway systems in Canada. The French-speaking city is Montreal. They have a proper subway, and we have a subway. Other large metropolitan cities, Calgary, Vancouver, Ottawa, they have light rail. It may have some sections that are underground, but most of it is either grade level or above grade light rail system. So there's only two subways that I know of, Montreal and Toronto. The company that's trying to put to do the $40 million Wi-Fi and cellular repeat here is the company that has already done it in Montreal. So Montreal is, they've had it for about 4 or 5 years now.
Well done. And I was hearing about Montreal, even though I couldn't think of the name of the town, and I believe much of their system, the communication between the stations, is maintained by fiber optics as opposed to radiax cable. The New York City subway system, most of the communication between stations in the tunnels is a radiax Andrew cable. And it has some pluses and minuses, but fiber optics is a much better way of doing it. So the Montreal system was fiber, working very well, and there were a number of companies who had knowledge or specific experience with Montreal who were proposing to make improvements in the subway system in New York City. The subway system in New York City to try to create better communications for fire, police, and whatever. I believe their proposal was in the $200 million category. So when Toronto is being fed a bid for 40 billion, it strikes me low, unless maybe the total number of miles and the total number of stations in Toronto is considerably less than New York City. Maybe you know that one. V3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Oh, you caught me flat-footed on the mileage for our system. I'm pretty sure the long east-west line is, for some reason I want to say 32 kilometers, but that's probably not right. No, it's a substantially smaller system. Just to put this in some context for you, our geographic landmass is just somewhat bigger than the continental United States, for about the same size, which is a little bit bigger landmass. There's only 37 million of us. And per our discussions on the Golden Horseshoe, 11 million of us are in the GTA region. So our scale is appreciably smaller than yours, even though we're about the same size on the globe.
Yeah, that became fairly clear to a buddy of mine who really liked a once-per-year wilderness experience. This friend of mine would go to the northern areas of Canada that are just barely occupied by human beings. Then he would walk north for about a week, camp out for a while, and walk back. And during these walks and camps, he carried no cell phone, no other emergency communication. He really wanted a wilderness experience. He told people where he was going, but he had no other safety lifeline, if you know what I mean. And this was, at the time, a 45-year-old man. And so, strikes me very unusual. Scares me a little bit into that situation that occurred with that rock climber who, all by himself, with no cell phone, went rock climbing. And an event occurred where his arm got jammed between two rocks. I think some of the rocks actually moved. And he was stuck there for a couple of days. And the only way he escaped and survived is he had to take out his Swiss Army knife and cut off his arm at the elbow. Can you imagine him during that procedure? He dropped that Swiss Army knife. Can you imagine the pain he went through to do that? I mean, you and I, who appreciate the benefit of wireless communication devices, would never put ourselves in that kind of a situation without some kind of a backup. V3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's quite true. I've mentioned before on your motorcycle, and I enjoy doing the canyon carving up north. That's where I go a little bit nuts. Very sane and safe rider on highways and street byways down here, but getting on some of those back twisty valley, mountain, canyon-type roads up north and elsewhere upstate New York is a lot of fun, too. Just around this time of year, we start going down there because the leaves are usually 2 to 3 weeks behind us, so we get to extend the riding season by going a little south into upstate New York. But I have my iPhone, which is, you know, my workaday tool, but I have a Samsung Rugby 3, which is a military-grade ruggedized phone, which is the one that goes on the motorcycle with me because it'll stand the vibration, the water, the dust, the bounce. If it goes for, if we go for a bounce, it'll survive because that's the one I want. The iPhone won't take it, whereas the Rugby 3 will. So those are the lengths I go to. I have two, and one's my biking phone, just for those reasons.
Well done. Millions of people in the New York City, New Jersey, Staten Island area during Superstorm Sandy realized that their cell phone went dead. They had essentially no way of charging it. I remember asking quite a few of those people, how many spare batteries do you own? And And their answer is, what was that? Do you own the charger that can be plugged into the cigarette lighter of the car to charge your cell phone? The answer is, what is that? Why do I need it? And so the people who get used to a cell phone and become very dependent on it down here, some of those people, you ask them, do you often listen to the radio? And their answer was, yeah, occasionally in my automobile I'll turn on the car, but other than that I never use radio. And then you ask them, what is that cell phone? Well, that's a telephone. Isn't that a radio? They never realized. I'm kind of amazed how some of the appliance operators don't worry about the details. They want the cell phone to be smaller and smaller to fit into their vest pocket. And what that does to the size of the battery doesn't concern them. It's just kind of crazy as I see it. Do you ever have any spare batteries for any of your portable devices, Scott? E3ZTZ, K2RIW?
I wouldn't go as far as calling myself a survivalist in the sense, in the classic and sense that it means to most Americans. But because of my discipline in IT and being an independent consultant for the last 2 years anyway, there are some agencies that have us under a retainer in case the big bad things happen. And they don't have a full complement of their own staff. So we're at a beck and call in certain crises. Because of that, I do have two go bags that are properly equipped for such things. And yes, I have on the flashlights that the big boys that I have a C-size mag light and a D-size D-cell mag light. So you have two different battery types. The store is going to run out of D's very quickly if you're reacting just in front of a known phenomenon happening, coming. It's going to be out if it's post the drama. But the C batteries tend to lie around, so you can make some choices there by diversifying your flashlights. I also have a lot of rechargeables, and was going to get a solar panel, but I'll put a pin on that for a little while. But I'm going to trip and come back. On air when we were talking about this, when you were doing this post Sandy, immediately thereafter. My building has a gym, and in that gym, it's got those pedal bikes with the LED displays that do the interval training and your heartbeat and all of that. And inside those pedal bikes, they're self-powered. They run off a dynamo from pedaling or your stair climbing. And there were people more enterprising than myself who had gone down, unscrewed the panel off the side, found the tap point, and realized it's about 5 volts, which you can use your USB charger with. And so there were people sitting there doing their 30-minute workout, charging their cell phones. I didn't mention that one at the time, but those stair climbers and pedal bikes that are self-powered, not the ones you plug in the wall and make the displays go, but self-powered, are a source of DC energy. DZ.
Well done, Scott. Was there someone else that wanted to join us?
It's Victor Echo 3, Juliet Indian Whiskey Jim, a buddy of Scott's.
Scott, I know you had a question for Jim before. You want to restate your question in case he didn't hear it?
Moving on air, club. I got your email. Dick was asking about VE3ONG, whether there were any stories that you, and I said you would know more about it than I. So if you've got anything on, any info on VE3ONG, bring it forward.
I don't remember much from a gentleman who was up there who came to the radio club one night. So I had nothing more to add on that, but I'm listening along. I You were right, I was listening on streaming. So I'll turn it back to KTORIW, E3JW in the group.
In other words, I guess you heard my story about what Alan KTUIH ran into as he did one of the operations on VE3ONT to put them on moonbound on a particular weekend. And he ran into some fairly strong Murphy's Law problems about the camera and keeping it alive that was doing the tracking, because I think the automatic computer equipment that would ordinarily run the dish was not operational, or they didn't know how to program it and run it and so on. So they were doing quasi-manual tracking by way of a camera. Over to you, Jim, K2RIW.
You hear all of that. I was listening on streaming, and I, again, enjoyed the net. And by the way, I was with Scott one night, local outage in the area, and other than we lost the Wi-Fi in the building would start our progress. We had lots of light, and until a laptop said, "I need power." So we were able to be hands and continue on with our little study group we were doing. No, he is a be prepared guy, but not a survivalist in the World Harvest Radio genre of survivalist.
Many of us are very dependent on our laptop. So under emergency situations, what's the easiest way of charging a laptop? I think very few people are equipped to charge a laptop from an automobile cigarette lighter. And in a multiple hour, multiple day blackout, the most convenient source of electrical power almost all of us have is our automobile, if you don't already have a motor generator set. And so I suspect rather few people have the ability to charge their laptop from the automobile. I might be wrong on that one. V3JIW, K2RIW.
Think of YUI. I have bought supplies that actually my laptop takes 12 volts. It's very simple, but I got an adapter that was multi-ranged for that type of thing. And what the other station I heard, I'll let you handle it. But my little laptop takes 12 volts. It's an Asus Triple E PC. Not a very competent machine, but over to you, Dick.
Okay, the new person joining us, go right ahead. I'm kind of curious how you're coming into the machine, because maybe you're going through the IRLP or EchoLink, but for whatever reason your signal is not coming out of the other Long Island machine. Back to you, Hank. That explains it. 146.85 tonight is turned off, even though it is linked to 147.375. 147.375. Anybody who goes in on that machine comes out of both. So that explains it. Out of curiosity, do you have the ability with the exact same PL to transmit on 147.375? I'm back to you, Hank.
C2IS info.
Go ahead, Bill.
I overheard your conversation about charging laptops, and are you thinking of inverters? I think a lot of people do have inverters nowadays.
So to use a 12-volt to 120-volt AC inverter is one approach, but that's a little bit brute force. I'd like to believe there's got to be some kind of an adapter that many laptop providers could supply, which goes directly from the 12-volt cigarette lighter through a chunk of electronics into the battery of the laptop. I'd like to believe that very few laptops have a voltage beyond 12 volts in their battery, and even if they did, the right kind of a chunk of electronics there, switching regulator, buck boost regulator, could easily handle that. AC2IS, K2RIW.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dick, and I believe just about about every laptop manufacturer has something like that you can buy, and almost nobody buys it.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, Bill, is nobody buys it because they're saying to themselves, that's not going to happen to me. And once every few years, it does happen to them. And I guess they think it's a once-in-a-lifetime situation. It keeps recurring every 3 or 4 years. Over to you, Bill.
Well, I don't know what's going on in people's heads, but it seems that they do buy inverters, or at least, you know, you can go to auto store inverters on hand. I think the deal is that, you know, you can buy an inverter. It'll work with what you've got. It's not specific to the model of the laptop. Whereas the other part, people would have to buy something that's special that they would not get other uses out of.
Okay. But in the case of using the 110-volt inverter, and you have to bring not only that, but the wall wart with you, to then, there's two chunks of electronics required to charge your laptop. If the direct charger from the 12 volt into the laptop is not very expensive, the fact that it can't be used on any other brand of laptop wouldn't bother me. What's your rough guess as to the price of that direct 12 volt to laptop device? Over to you, Bill, K2RIW.
I'm going to guess that these things are still stupidly overpriced, so I will say $60.
Okay. For a man of your resources, $60 is not a gating item. $160, yes, without a doubt, it'll stop you. But $60, I mean, any of us can waste $60 in a year real easily by making a couple of foolish decisions. So I think that's the right price. I have the impression that only one laptop owner in 10 or 20 owns this device. Is that approximately right, Bill?
I would say far less than that. Maybe 1 in 10 has an inverter, but I would say less than 1 in 100 has this DC adapter for their laptop. And if I were to buy one, then, you know, typically that's not something I would use. Maybe the issue is when the lights go out and it's dark out, what are the odds of my being able to find it? I think the odds of my still having it in my laptop bag are going to be pretty low.
V3ZZZ info.
Go ahead, Jim. Correction, Scott. V3ZZZ with info. K2RIW. Go ahead, Scott. While we're waiting for him to come back, Bill, since that direct device between car and laptop can only be used from the car, the right place to keep it is in the car. That way you know where it is. Over to you, Bill.
Okay, good point. The fact that it's a, you know, single purpose, single use device, and the inverter is a multi-use device, that's what makes a difference for people. You know, even if they don't have a car charger for their phone, they know they'll be able to charge their phone if they have the charger with them. And, you know, the same for any number of other devices that they might happen to want to power up in the car.
That's one you'll carry with you all the time because it plugs into the wall, and then you have a cord that has the cigarette adapter on it or the alligator clips, whatever you need to do, and the pin that then drives it via 12 volts. When I actually have a Lenovo now, which does not have an option like that, but when I was lugging my Dells around, that's the baby I had, was the hybrid one. And it's a good idea if you're aware of such things. V3 that you said through.
Makes sense. Yeah, I do see the universality of a 110-volt, 120-volt inverter. They run lots of things on it. And I've owned a few of those in my time. In the old days, they put out a square wave, 120-volt square wave, which of course didn't have the 167-volt peak. Therefore, some very simple power supplies didn't operate correctly. I think nowadays almost all of them run a stepped square wave, where the peak is 167 and the RMS is 120. And so incandescents and power supplies are all kept relatively happy. I wonder if any of us have ever seen the actual waveform coming out of a modern day 120 volt inverter. KQLIW. Okay, I think that was you, Hank. And Hank, we're hearing you out of the 375 machine by way of the 85 input. But I guess you weren't able to light up the 375. And maybe the reason is that the 375 in your direction might have an antenna that's a little bit less sensitive. Over to you, Hank, KQLIW. Very fine, Hank. Hank, has anyone discovered why their electronics doesn't like the stepped inverter? The old-fashioned ones only put out 120-volt square wave, a 50% duty cycle, 100% square wave. And the new stepped waveform has a small step in the middle that goes to 167, which is the same peak you get out of the sine wave, and another voltage, I'm guessing it's 100 or something like that, for the other step. So it puts out 100 for a while, 167 briefly, back to 100, and then reverses for the other polarity. So why would electronics not like that, if you happen to know? Over to you, Hank, K2RAW. Yeah, it would be interesting to find out why not. Similarly, any of the microwave hands who run a traveling wave tube power supply on portable electronics, they all have a lot of trouble with the power supply tripping out. Even though the sine wave coming out of a motor generator set might on an oscilloscope look really pure, still there's minor little glitches in it. Somehow the power supply false alarms on those glitches and thinks that there's an arc over taking place in the traveling wave tube, and it goes into its standby and crowbar mode. And so, finding out what's wrong with motor generator power. Also during Hurricane Sandy, a lot of people discovered that when running motor generator power into the UPS, the UPS would continuously cycle back and forth between the UPS generated versus line generated from the motor generator. So it would continuously cycle back and forth, and it did it so rapidly for such a long period of time that the switching network would fail. And so, again, a UPS doesn't like motor generator power. K2RIW listening, if anybody wants to comment on the above. One last question for you, Scott. You've probably heard my tirade on a number of occasions about antenna instruction, antenna design instruction. In North America, in Europe, in Asia, in Australia. I wonder, some of the comments I make as to the way I consider an antenna, the way a dipole operates, and whatever. Are you hearing it for the first time from me, or have you heard portions of that story from your previous instructors? And maybe the electrical engineering instruction you get in Canada, in the GTA, maybe is considerably better. V3ZTZ, K2RIW.
Well, my formal education was not in electronics or radio, so...
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
81, Mike Juliet, Mike Dick, are you still out there?
Yes, I am, Hank. And I can tell that 11 o'clock, actually 1 in the morning, the link disconnects itself. Over to you, Hank.
Mike.
Hey, Hank, you're now coming out of both machines, so you must be going into 375, 147, 375. Who is that person who just called me?
A1, Mike Juliet, Mike. 01, Mike Juliet, Mike.
Go right ahead, Mike.
I just had a little comment about, you mentioned generators, and I just had a little comment about generators. Is this a good time?
Has a good time. It's one of the many subjects on the floor. Go ahead, Mike.
During our last person exchange, here. I have a old window generator. It's a 8.5 kilowatt continuous 10 kilowatt surge, and it failed on me for the first time in a very long time. I picked it up around the same time as Hurricane Gloria hit. I know you got yours on the same time, and it failed because of the capacitor that died on it.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard that report, Mike. I presume you're talking about a capacitor that's in the alternator section. I'd like to believe that that capacitor, you being a pretty smart electrical engineer, were able to troubleshoot it. I'd like to believe it's a replaceable item. Of the 525 generators that were sold on Long Island, in 1985/86, after Hurricane Gloria, and I was involved in that operation of that purchase and resale. Yours is the only, maybe one other guy, I think I heard a capacitor failing. And maybe one other guy. So, how difficult was that to troubleshoot? How difficult was that to replace? K1 Mike, Juliet Mike, K2RIW.
About a half hour to troubleshoot it. It didn't take very long. With no electricity, I jury-rigged some batteries and a resistor in order to test the capacitance on it. It was easy to evaluate. The motor ran good. Everything spun. It was brushless, so on and so forth. There weren't a lot of components that could have failed on it, so I narrowed it down very quick. I told the manufacturer, let me break here. I called the manufacturer, and I asked him for another one. Oh, it's very easy to replace, so asked him about it, and I gave him the date code, and he said it's about the right length of time before it's expected to fail. It's a mil spec cap, and he said it's the right time that it's expected to fail around now, so he said I got a good life out of it, actually.
I'm kind of curious now, in your troubleshooting procedure, what did you use to confirm the capacitor had failed? And a capacitor can fail as a short circuit, an open circuit, or the dielectric material can dry out and the capacitance go to an extremely small number of microfarads. Which was the failure? And I'll bet you somebody in the world makes that, and maybe it's an AC electrolytic capacitor, which are a little bit more special in the design. I'll bet you somebody makes a motor start capacitor of that number of microfarads that maybe would have a considerably longer life. Over to you, Mike. K1 Mike, Julian Mike, K2RIW.
Dick, you got that right. This is AC cap. This is 70 microfarad, 450 volt AC. Big cap. It's a juicy hand size, a little bit bigger than a juicy hand. And yes, it failed. Just by losing capacitance, I put a group of batteries together and put a resistor across it, charged it, and put my voltmeter across it, and measured how long it took to discharge, and calculated it was down below 1 microfarad, as good as I can read with my voltmeter.
Oh, wow. When that's only putting out 1 microfarad as opposed to the 70 because of the dryout procedure. And by the way, the Cornell Duvalier antenna rotators that were very famous, very popular 20 years ago, had a paper-covered 120 microfarad, I think it was 120 microfarad, 120 volt AC capacitor, that when they dried out, as they went down to lower and lower microfarads, the amount of torque you could get out of the antenna rotator got smaller and smaller, and eventually it wouldn't move. And it almost wouldn't move on a cold winter day. And everybody thought that the grease was freezing up and drying out. And it had nothing to do with it. And then when you put a real motor start capacitor in there, boy, you got tremendous torque. I am guessing your generator either put out very few watts or not the right voltage when it was down to 1 microfarad. And it would be curious to know what would it do when you were passing through and we're still at the 10 microfarad area. Would you not get full power output? What's your guess as to the response you get? Change in voltage or change in power output as a function of microfarads? K1 Mike, Juliet Mike, K2RIW.
still on one, Mike Juliet. Mike, yes, you think it may